I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our conversation about Thriving Communities, Thriving State, an initiative of the Indiana University Public Policy Institute that aims to study and perhaps implement ways to energize Indiana from the roots up. My guests are the project's co-chairs, former Indiana Lieutenant Governor Kathy Davis and former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Randall Shepard, and the project's director, Mark Lawrence. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our conversation about Thriving Communities, Thriving State. That's a project by the Indiana University Public Policy Institute that now is entering its second phase. We're going to find out what that entails. And we've got a couple of illustrious guests. We're going to find out why they signed on as co-chairs. If you would like to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are former Lieutenant Governor Kathy Davis and former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Randall Shepard, both of whom are co-chairs for Thriving Communities, Thriving State, and the program director, Mark Lawrence. Welcome, all of you. It's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Thanks,
to be,
John.
Great to be around.
So I think I will throw this question first. I'm going to use the honorary titles. Normally, radio is an intimate medium, but I think, and you go by first names, but I think in this case, Lieutenant Governor Davis, could you talk a little bit, since we have done a show on this before, but there may be some people listening who weren't listening to that first program, bring people up to date on what Thriving Communities, Thriving State is.
Thriving Communities, Thriving State is a conversation being led by the Public Policy Institute that has gathered leaders from across the state to talk about priorities for efforts organized by urban areas, mid-sized communities, and rural and small towns. And the idea is that by organizing geographically, that we will lift up, as you described it, from the roots up, what are the most important priorities and how are they similar and different depending where we are in the state.
Okay. And Chief Justice Shepard, you talk a little bit about how you and the Lieutenant Governor got involved in this.
The truth is, I don't actually remember, but both of us have had connections to the Public Policy Institute in other endeavors and in other times, and this new iteration, this new initiative, seemed like a good way to spend time and energy. It has its objective, drawing in people from various viewpoints to talk about Indiana's future and to get, with the help of the staff of the Institute, to analyze what Indiana's needs are and where the greatest opportunities might lie. And that's a thing worth being part of.
Mark, I'm going to ask you, I'd mentioned obviously that the project is entering its second phase right now. Could you talk about what the first phase was, what it accomplished, and really where we're going with the second phase right now?
Sure. The first phase has been, and we are still in the development phase of the ideas of these commissions. We're almost through with that. We're going to have a lot of work to organize the thoughts and ideas that came from the three separate commissions. But we're making great progress on that. Each of the commissions has their own priorities they selected based on a variety of issues they could have chosen. And the second phase, though, is getting into the education phase. Being on programs like this is a part of that, but we're trying to educate citizens around the state, leaders, policy leaders, state and local, people in the not-for-profit community, and business leaders and so forth, on some of the ideas that are starting to emerge from Thriving Communities, Thriving State. And we are looking at ideas with sort of the time frame of doing things that would go beyond election cycles, but maybe over the next 10 years, what kind of things would we want to accomplish for the state? And we think those are important. So we're the education phase is starting, and after that, we will get into hopefully an extensive implementation aspect.
And to sort of summarize, from the earlier conversation, and we've alluded to it here, really there were three different groups or commissions looking at problems or challenges and opportunities associated with urban communities, right? And then sort of mid-sized communities and small town or rural communities. At the risk of trying the patience of the folks who listened to that first program, we probably ought to revisit some of where were the breakdowns on that? How did we define urban? How did we define mid-size? How did we define what was a small community?
Sure. The small towns in rural Indiana were basically communities 15,000 and below. And I would say of Indiana, we know that 96% of our state's geography is occupied by small towns and rural. 54% of the population are in those areas. The mid-size area is basically between 15 and 50,000, although we included suburban communities such as Carmel and Fishers, whose population is above 50,000. That's 1.8% of our state's land mass and 16.2% of the population. Urban communities, which are basically 50,000 and above, are 2.2% of our land mass in Indiana and 30% of the population, but 42% of all the jobs. So we're learning a lot more about that. And the goal is to try to look, too, at the interdependence between those three areas, because oftentimes in a variety of arenas, you know, it tends to be an urban-rural tension. And what we're trying to emphasize here is the interdependence of all three of those areas for Indiana to thrive, not only at the state level, but also at the regional level.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Thriving Communities, Thriving State. That's a project by the Indiana University Public Policy Institute that aims to sort of energize from the state from the roots up. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, the conversation has so far resulted in some findings then, right? Some evidence. How about if we start by talking about the places where we found either the challenges or the opportunities in those three groups overlapped. And then we'll get to the breakpoint. We'll start at the points of commonality first. And I'll start with you, Chief Justice Shepherd, primarily because you're nodding your head.
Risking that, I guess. There are some commonalities. People come at them in different ways. But two very closely related fields which have been much the part of the discussion both in the meetings that we've held in various parts of Indiana and also in the meetings of these commissions are the importance of lifting up educational opportunity for people who start out their lives here. There are other elements of that, like how do you make this an attractive place for people who started somewhere else to come and stake their fortune. But I've been surprised a little that all three of these groups that come at it from very different sorts of places have made such a point of saying that additional education and training opportunities are things they see as crucial to the economic future, the place where they reside and work. Now, a closely allied theme has been the fostering and supporting of, if you will, indigenous or local leadership. And that's a topic that doesn't always get talked about in quite that way. People don't necessarily, when they're sitting down to do a planning exercise, work into the word leadership or building leadership or talent. But there's been a fair amount of that, both in certainly in the medium-sized community commission and the one on rural areas. A lot of concern about whether the people who could help push things forward either aren't being nurtured or have made decisions in numbers that are unhappy to go somewhere else.
Is that, to follow up real quickly, and I guess I would toss that to either of the co-chairs here, that sort of perceived need, challenge, I'm not sure what word to use with leadership, I presume they're not talking exclusively about political leadership. It's about the, you know, business leadership, about finding community leaders, people who are willing to serve on boards, to volunteer, and all of that. How is that manifesting itself? I mean, what evidence are we seeing that there is a leadership vacuum in some of these communities? Lieutenant Governor Davis?
I think part of it is the recognition that building talent has a lot of factors, that it starts with a good job and a strong economy that we're building our talent for, and then it involves preschool and success in K through 12 and sometimes mentorship that needs to go along with that. Same thing in higher education, an adoption of the goal that Lumina Foundation for Education has been promoting, that 60% of our adults have a high quality certificate or degree, and that raises the question, what is a high quality certificate? And I think these are issues that we succeed in when we have a broad collaboration between the education community, not-for-profits, human services, certainly the business community, and even law enforcement. And that if we are to be successful in turning the dial on these changes that are complicated, we really need a broad set of leaders, each doing their part, each interacting with students and workforce at the right time in their lives in order to make a difference. And so we need lots of leaders. It's not just the elected officials. It's people in all of these disciplines coming together to do their part to make a difference over the long term. So we need not just a few leaders, we need many leaders.
And I think I heard the Chief Justice say that problem or whatever the term would be seemed to be most acute at the mid-sized community level, or was there any evidence, Mark, I'll throw it your way, that it was evenly spread out, or is there one of those groups that seems to be feeling it, the need, most more acutely than the others?
Well, each of the commissions have had different discussions on that. For example, at the urban area, they talked about forward-thinking leadership with an engaged citizenry. Rural was promoting and develop local civic leadership. And the mid-size area was looking at really civic leadership and engagement in philanthropy. And I think back to what Lieutenant Governor Davis said earlier, part of these commissions and the talk of leadership comes, we have a very diverse group of people serving as commissioners on all three commissioners. They come from the private sector, the public sector, and the not-for-profit sector. And so I think that blend of talent that have stepped forward and have agreed to volunteer their precious time towards this project are helping us with a broad-based approach that we believe will serve us well. And I think, as also was said earlier, this is a ground-up approach from the standpoint of how we can engage communities in a way that has not been done in Indiana before.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Thriving Communities, Thriving State. That's a project by the Indiana University Public Policy Institute. Its goal is to find ways to energize Indiana from the roots up. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Again, we are talking about thriving communities, thriving state. My guests are the project's co-chairs, former Lieutenant Governor Kathy Davis and former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Randall Shepard, as well as the program director, Mark Lawrence. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Thriving Communities, Thriving State. That's a project by Indiana University's Public Policy Institute that studies and hopes to implement ways to energize the state from the roots up. My guests are the project's co-chairs, former Indiana Lieutenant Governor Kathy Davis, former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Randall Shepard, and the program director, Mark Lawrence. And I should say that former Lieutenant Governor Davis and former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Shepard are the project's co-chairs. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Margaret has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Margaret, welcome to the program.
First of all, thank you.
Certainly.
And I'm calling in with nothing but the highest regard and hope, given the demonstrated integrity of Lieutenant Governor Davis and Chief Supreme Court Justice Randall Shepard. I forgive me, I bumbled that. And, as, of course, you, Mr. Kroll, and Mark Lawrence, if you're involved with this, then it extends to you as well. I'm calling as a fifth-generation Hoosier who was out of the state for 20 years and came back. I've been back about 19 years now. Let me see if I can cut to the chase. The key here to engage citizenry, and I base this on experience of working both for Senator Patrick Leahy, as well as Mayor McCloskey, both when Mayor McCloskey was both mayor as well as congressman in Washington, and raised in by citizens who said, no matter what our political affiliation was, we're Americans first, and we all have a responsibility as citizens to work toward bringing the behavior of public projects in alignment with the spirit of the law. If the law needs to be changed, you work through the established system. Having said that, I've been so discouraged, and as recently as this spring, to learn firsthand, not by hearsay, but firsthand, that the electric car program, which I think is fabulous. I've been for alternative energy, worked for that as far back as 40 years ago, and I want to be so happy for it. I take it as an example of what citizens are up against and why there's terrific mistrust and reluctance to get involved at the local roots, and that is to learn that here's this wonderful idea of the electric cars in the big city, urban area, which turns out that it got started just like a few other things. And again, I speak from first-hand experience. It just sidestepping and ignoring all the established laws about how you go about engaging new ideas, how do you spend the money. And so my point being, and I only to learn that for this, it has been terrifically sidestepped. I sat in the council session where blow by blow, the so-called contract was analyzed against the laws for procurement that the city.
Margaret,
only to learn
Margaret,
that there's a question here.
No, I know, and I want to make sure because I'm seeing other calls lining up here, and I want to give them a chance too.
But my point is, how can this project, the Thriving Communities, Thriving State, that wants to generate at the grassroots level, address the fact that the Chamber of Commerce's, so many of the businesses, and certain elected officials just plain sidestep how they're supposed to go about starting new projects? It creates, and I speak from firsthand experience with friends and professional colleagues who are so cynical because here are all these great ideas, but they come about in a way, not what you're doing. I'm saying we see it day in and
yes.
day out.
Yeah, Margaret, let me step in. I think I know where you're going with this.
Okay.
And it really is a question of how people can have faith in the process
when it
is often
seems to be circumvented. And why should they get involved and spend their time when somebody behind the scenes who thinks they're a big muckety-muck just ignores the law or ignores what the committee decides or ignores whatever? And again, going back to
Margaret,
Davis,
I'm going to get
Shepherd. We've got hope here with them.
Thank you very much.
The charge.
Thanks very
Thank
much
you.
For the call, Margaret. Lieutenant Governor Davis, I'm going to throw that one your way initially, which is, you know, because it is a question at some level about how the political process can be thwarted or the policymaking process can be thwarted, done end around it. Has this project revealed any sort of disenchantment with the way the process works? I mean, what Margaret was speaking to was a distrust that produced a disengagement from public questions and public involvement altogether.
I think Margaret's point, well, one thing about Margaret's point is that she was at the council meeting. So she herself has mm-hmm. stepped in and called foul and gotten engaged. And I think that the project certainly has acknowledged a need for higher civic engagement. All right, our voter turnout, I believe, was second worst in the country in the last election as one indicator that we need more people involved. I think the conversation about leadership, especially in the rural and mid-sized communities where, you know, folks are concerned about their young people growing up in the community and moving away and not staying to be leaders. You know, there are lots of ways to get disenchanted. And so I think involvement and having success is one way to be inspired and stay inspired. And so we need to do what Margaret did, which is go and participate and communicate and expect that things are going to be doing better the next time because, you know, folks are watching.
And I should add, during the break, you pointed out that there were differences in the nature of the leadership problems at the various community levels. Can we talk a little bit about that before we move on to other parts of the findings so far?
Yeah, that was very interesting, that leadership is a top priority among all three commissions. But in the rural and mid-sized community commissions, the issue is how do we attract our young people into leadership positions? How do we use the opportunity of leadership positions to keep them within the community? In the urban areas, it was how do we get the folks who have been leaders for a long time to step back and let the young people in? So it's, you know, how do we get Kathy Davis to stop serving on quite as many boards and commissions and let the young people, you know, have an opportunity?
I'm assuming they didn't actually name
No, they didn't name me, but I felt guilty, I guess.
By the way, thanks to Margaret for mentioning Mayor McCluskey. I was on the McCluskey Highway last week, Margaret, and I wish he were still here and engaged with us.
We are talking about thriving communities, thriving state here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, we are a proud IPS family, and we have also had two of our three children in private schools. And this is the first year that we have been able to have all three of our kids served just extraordinarily well by IPS schools. One of our children has special needs. And when you talk about strong leadership, I just want to give a shout out to the leadership team that is at the Shortridge New IB World School. Because when we had our parent-teacher conferences last week, every single one of the teachers, both in special education and in general education, was prepared and was aware of who of each of our children was. And it's just great to see that trickle-down effect that you've been mentioning come to play and provide a really world-class education for our kids for free. So we're just very supportive of public education. And yesterday at the Midtown event for education at Children's Museum, it was great to see what Deb Stahl put together, to see a lot of great educational opportunities out there for the parents and the families here in Indianapolis. So I just hope that we keep supporting public education for all of our different kind of learners.
Thank you very much for the call and for sharing your story, Rebecca.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that since I obviously was somewhat remiss in not asking whether there were differences in, you know, in the need for leadership at the community level at each of these levels. I probably should ask whether, since the other common theme was they wanted additional educational opportunities or stronger education systems at all three levels, was it the same, was the need perceived to be the same there, or were there differences in the way they framed it? Lieutenant Governor Davis, you're looking at me significantly, so I'm going to go with you.
I think each of the commissions wants more information about the skill gap now and in the future that will drive their education initiatives. So everybody recognizes that the economy of the future needs different skills than we have in our workforce today. But what exactly those differences are is what's going to drive the solutions. So I think each of the commissions is wanting to understand that better and looking to the Public Policy Institute, perhaps, to help them do that.
Mark, can you amplify?
Well, sure. We had at the most recent commission meeting, the one that preceded the one last week, Jamie Marisotis with the Lumina Foundation, who is out unveiling his new book, America Needs Talent, was great. He really set out some really broad objectives that he has in his book that were really taken up and taken seriously by all three of the commissions. It was interesting, though, on the rural commissions, it was a little bit more of workforce supply and demand. We heard something which I've heard quite a bit. It's just hard to get someone to walk in the door that's, you know, has basic work skills, can pass a drug test, and so forth and so on. In the urban areas, they really wanted to access world-class education opportunities for all Indiana residents, but they felt it was really important, I think, as just the previous caller talked about. She's having a great experience at IPS. That's great, and we need to have more of those stories percolating up.
We've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Deanne. If you'd like to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Deanne says, back in the 80s, there were some who talked about the value of regionalism, the National Geographic constructs of areas working within to form a viable, interconnected, and inclusive network of communities. Competition overshadows a more useful focus, which is cooperation. Most areas in Indiana have something that makes them unique with the potential to develop for the benefit of the citizens as well as to entice those from without to consider coming in. Just considering each town or county is thinking too small while only seeking a benefit for the state, may be too large. We need to stop privatizing every patch of grass. Geist is a perfect example. And it goes on from there, but I think the argument there, if I am not framing your argument correctly, I hope you'll call me to task on that, is really that we shouldn't be looking necessarily at these communities in isolation or at the state, but in ways that perhaps communities can work together across boundaries. Is that part of the focus of this study or this project, Mark?
Yes, it is. We can look at where people live and work, and we have in a compendium we put together that's available on our website. It's a commuting map, and it shows inbound commuting, and you can see just people naturally gravitate to certain areas based on their commuting habits. So the concept of regions, I believe, is very important, and because each of those areas, there are urban areas, there are mid-size areas, and there are rural areas, and some people choose to work in a rural area and live in an urban area, or vice versa. So this interdependence goes beyond just commuting patterns, though. It has to do with the delivery of services, and I think there's a lot of thinking that, and I know in different parts of the state, they've really moved forward on regional thinking to really help economically. They used to fight with a job opportunity opening up on one side of the county line or the other, and now they're celebrating as jobs coming into the region as a good thing. And so we hope that we can move that forward even more with this project.
Got an email from a listener named Chad who says he is listening from Elkhart. Thanks for tuning in, Chad. And if others want to reach us via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Starts out by thanking Chief Justice Shepard and former Lieutenant Governor Davis for your service to our great state. And then it asks, has the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the fallout from it had any immediate effect on the Thriving Communities, Thriving State project? Do you foresee one in the future? I mean, is that popped up? Presumably some of these conversations were taking place right in the middle of that. Was there any effect? Chief Justice Shepard.
I don't have a recollection of these discussions being directly impacted. I don't have any doubt that it's going to make a difference in Indiana's near term and long term, unless we manage it very well. But I think it has not, it may be a little early to evaluate the impact. I mean, we've had a few instances where it's been announced that a given convention has decided to come after all, or mm-hmm. come anyway, if you will. I think there will be some moments that we won't hear about because somebody will choose not to make the phone call or to come and look at us for a given opportunity, and that decision will get made in Denver or Tampa, and they won't call us and tell us why. So I do think it's an important question for Indiana, worth spending some time in 2016 trying to sort out. I haven't seen it so far to have changed the course of the discussions and the evaluations that have been ongoing in our commissions.
Did it, Mark? Was it part of that? I mean, again, because those conversations were taking place almost simultaneously, did it bleed over? I mean, did it become part of the conversation in any way?
Yeah, it did in several of the commission meetings that I attended. And I think one of the things that when we look at, we right now are not importing people to Indiana. Our net migration rate is negative. So we are exporting more people. So to the degree that Indiana was perceived as not welcoming or other things, and this is a generational issue as well, because we want to attract young, talented people to come to Indiana to be the best and the brightest to come. So anything that hinders that would hinder that. So those were part of the discussions.
We are talking about Thriving Communities, Thriving State here on No Limits. My guests are former Indiana Lieutenant Governor Kathy Davis, former Indiana Chief Justice Randall Shepard, and the program's director, Mark Lawrence. I'm John Krall. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about Thriving Communities, Thriving State. That is a project by the Indiana University Public Policy Institute that aims to energize Indiana from the roots up. My guests are the project's co-chairs, former Indiana Lieutenant Governor Kathy Davis and former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Randall Shepard, as well as the program's director, Mark Lawrence. We've talked about the places, the overlapping needs or challenges that these communities saw. And to reiterate for those who just joined us, the project studies Indiana at three different levels: urban communities, mid-sized communities, and rural or small-town communities, with the breakpoints being at 50,000 population and 15, roughly. And I guess we probably ought to talk, though, about whether there were differences, whether these we saw, you know, points of differentiation in this, where, you know, the state urban communities may have been moving in one direction, rural communities another. Could we talk a little bit about that? Mark, I have not called on you first yet during this program, so I'm going to throw you under the bus on this one first.
Well, I think that the commissions, as they have focused on different things, and I've had the luxury of going into each of the commission meetings, but I only get a slice of them. So, but I do get an idea of the kind of topics they were talking about. And the education area, that was the one where they were talking roughly about the same topic the same day. And it was really interesting to see, once again, how rural areas were looking at, say, something like workforce and workforce development and getting the workers for the jobs that they felt were unfilled by unqualified workers. And the contrast between that and the urban areas, that they really felt we've got to attract the best and the brightest talent. And so therefore it got into placemaking and other things that are important to younger people. One of the things that I mentioned earlier, though, is the migration patterns that are going on in Indiana. Mm-hmm. And it's a known fact that rural areas are losing population, urban areas are gaining population. And we've documented that in one of the reports that we did at the beginning of this. And so I think that's a factor we need to be thinking about as going forward over the next 10, 20 years. How does that impact our state? And hopefully, once again, with the idea of this plan and these ideas, that we will advance some ideas that will get some traction to be implemented.
And I'll throw this question to, you know, the person who had to hold a you know, an elected office as lieutenant governor. You know, that divide, perceived divide between rural Indiana and urban Indiana is one of the fault lines in Indiana politics, in some ways in Indiana culture. How do we negotiate that? I mean, I'm assuming that's also part of this project's aims is to get us, at least in theory, remembering that we are all citizens of the same state, that we're all supposed to be in this together.
Well, I think part of it comes from where we have common issues, solving them together. But I think it also comes from recognizing what's most important in each area in order to be successful. And I think one of the clearest differences is for rural areas, which Mark mentioned, have 96% of the land area and I think about 37% of the jobs, and the priority that the Rural Commission is putting on entrepreneurship as a way to grow jobs. It's clearly the way jobs are growing across the country, and it's a great opportunity for rural communities if they have high-speed internet connection, which they don't. And this is an issue, an infrastructure issue, that we've talked about for a long time and wondered what role the state might have in pulling the market along and providing high-speed internet into our rural areas. And I hope that the Rural Commission is going to come on very strong about what a necessity that is, because we can do any kind of business anywhere in the state if we're connected.
I want to ask this because and I don't know a really diplomatic way to ask the question, but one of the things that you see now in a lot of our public discussions is really this tremendous undercurrent of fear, you know, that the rate of change and all of that are taking us places that we are just not ready for yet. We get it a lot in when we do shows of this nature, people calling in and saying, okay, we're afraid jobs are going away, you know, the rural communities, we're afraid we're losing population, we're afraid the schools aren't serving us well, we're afraid we're not getting the leadership we need, all of that, you know, the theme that ties all of those together is we're afraid. In terms of these conversations, were they picking up that kind of anxiety that seems to be just below the surface of every public discussion we have these days? Chief Justice Shepherd.
I think certainly in the rural communities, there's a lot of anxiety because there is this long-term trend about population movement and job movement and the transferring of opportunities, which is very serious. If you were to look at a map, for instance, of the difference in population by townships, there's really a stunning map that shows the difference in which townships in Indiana grew in the 2010 census and which ones lost. There are vast parts of the state that are white because there are fewer people living there now than there were in 2000. And they are mostly moving inside Indiana. They're migrating to relatively larger communities. And it's right that we have net out-migration, not by a whole lot statewide, even while the population is going up. But if I were a parent or somebody who owned a business in one of these communities that was continually losing population, it would worry me a lot. And I try to think about it. What would you actually do? My colleague has mentioned one very specific kind of thing that, namely broadband access, that is a thing you could probably figure out how to do that, couldn't you? You'd figure out who was going to pay for it and what did you actually have to do and who were the actors were. In some ways, it's a great task because you figure you can probably do something about it, and some of the others are a little harder. But yeah, I'd be very worried if I were in the places where life was getting thinner.
I would, I realize I've been remiss. I should take a step back and ask the question: are they leaving because of a lack of economic opportunity, or are there other forces that are prompting people to leave rural communities in Indiana? Mark, I'm going to throw that one to you.
Sure. There are, I think, we've talked about this, where young people would go, and if they go to get an education somewhere, and is there an opportunity for them to get a job that would be commensurate with their education in a rural area or even a small town or medium-sized town? And for many people, the answer to that is no, and that's why they tend to go to a larger city where there's a greater abundance of opportunities. One of the factors, too, in addition to just this migration, is how we are aging as a state. And we've done some demographic work to show that the rural areas are aging much more rapidly than mid-sized communities or urban areas. And I think it goes to younger people tend to be attracted to the urban areas. And so, you know, this is a national demographic issue, the aging of the baby boomers, but it's going to impact rural areas even more so than in the urban areas.
We've gotten an email from a listener, a regular listener named Marion, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Marion says that she's from rural Indiana and wants to know, how can you help us in rural Indiana protect our land, the animals, and the source of our food from the devastating effects of agribusiness, the construction of confined animal feeding operations and land usage to grow crops to feed and fuel them? Marion, I'm going to take the liberty of broadening that question a little bit and just say, did concern about environmental protection or environmental issues, or, you know, to take it even broader, quality of life issues bubble up in any of these commissions? I'll start with you, Mark.
Well, quality of life did, specifically, and I'd say the urban areas probably more so than in the rural. And mind you, each of these commissions had a limited amount of topics they could study in depth. And so the environment wasn't specifically set aside as a one of the issues they'd talk about. In the predecessor initiative to this, which was 4 years ago, which is Policy Choices for Indiana's Future, energy and the environment were discussed quite a bit in that, and specific recommendations were made, but it wasn't on this urban, rural, mid-size purview.
Let me ask this, because obviously there's a lot of effort going into collecting this information, having these conversations. What is the goal here? I mean, what is supposed to be the outcome of this project that we're supposed to arrive at? Lieutenant Governor Davis.
The goal is to have a plan of things that we're going to do in order to make the state better, and that pulling back from the recommendations in policy choices one that looked at kind of broad policy areas across the state, and now coming from the roots up to identify the vital few things that are going to make a difference community by community, to kind of blend those together and say we can't do everything at once. We, you know, most of our energy is devoted to running our state and our communities and our businesses day to day. But for those things that are most important to change, let's identify what those are, the things that are really going to move the needle on our quality of life in the state.
And how much of this will be, is likely to be implemented at the public policy level? I mean, there's been a long history in this state of commissions and studies that come up with recommendations, and then they enter into the political process. And like so many things, when they enter the political process, they come out not resembling what they started as.
The answer to that I've finally settled on is that you never get it all, but you get done what you can and leave some for the next folks. Even in recent times, there were pieces of policy choices. There were pieces of the local government reform and exercise that got implemented. And I lean towards the glass being half full. And so I tell myself that we're glad we got some of those things done, or somebody else got some of them done, because we helped foster the thinking or the conversation. And I won't walk away from the game because 100% of it didn't happen.
What is it, Mark? Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add and say that I think when people look at in Washington, D.C., they see dysfunction. They see the State House. Think more things get done there than otherwise, but we all are aware of, some of the things that go on that you hear about the legislature and so forth. At the community level, a lot of things get done, but, local politics can be political too, but it's really important to think about the degree of alignment that we get with not just political leaders, but also civic leaders and those in the not-for-profit community. They have a very valuable voice. We have members of some of the community foundations from around the state. They tend to be the convener of thought and ideas in their areas, and they're a very important ingredient in this. And so I want to say, to the degree we can achieve as much alignment on not only policies, but practices that can be done to help uplift Indiana in the three respective areas, that's really what we would like to do.
Who will the recommendations and the findings be presented to?
We hope an awful lot of people. Let's just start with the gubernatorial candidates. We will go with legislators and legislative candidates. And then after that, citizens, groups around the state. There's various associations of not-for-profit leaders, local government leaders with Indiana Association of Cities and Towns, Association of Counties, and there's a lot of other groups that we plan to make sure that they are aware of some of these ideas for their consideration.
And what is the timetable? I know you're in the second phase. Is the second phase the last phase, or is there another phase after that?
Well, we hope that we want to have the uptake of these ideas as much as possible. That's going to really go through 2016. We hope it'll be a part of the gubernatorial discussions and legislative discussions. And beyond that, hopefully in the planning that goes on, more long-range planning beyond any election cycle. So we hope the uptake starts sometime in 2016 on some of these ideas.
I've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Michael that I'm going to try to squeeze in. He says, contrary to what one person said earlier, Indiana has never been a great state. At best, it is mediocre and falls consistently in the bottom half of all states for quality of life measurements, such as education, health care, wages, environmental quality, etc. And when you factor in the regressive bigotry, religious extremism, corporate privatization of government functions, i.e. schools, and regressive taxation represented by the Republican governors and legislature in Indiana, it's easy to understand why the state is a not very attractive place to live for many young, educated people. Well, obviously not a fan of Indiana state government. I think we can start with that. Is there a way to measure, though, that's not an entirely uncommon belief, out of this study, the sort of lack of you know, Michael, again, I'm going to take the liberty of putting words in your mouth, public investment in quality lives. Lieutenant Governor Davis.
Well, I think therein is the leadership challenge. And I think that's why the commissions are very focused on collaborations within the community. I think one of the benefit of Roots Up is that there are lots of efforts being identified that are within the control of the community. And they may ask state government for help, but they're not sitting back and asking for state government to make a policy change before they act. And I think this sort of dire perspective on Indiana is in some ways the challenge that is in front of us. The members of the commission are really strong local leaders, so they are very encouraging about what we can accomplish, but we have to set the goals, we have to mean it, we have to identify what's going to get us there and do it, and that's what this is about.
For the moment, I'm afraid that will have to be the last word, but I hope that all of you will come back when you are at the final point and you have the complete findings and the recommendations so that we can talk about it. It is a fascinating project. I'd like to thank my guests, former Indiana Lieutenant Governor Kathy Davis, former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Randall Shepard, and Mark Lawrence from the Indiana University Public Policy Institute for a lively conversation. I'd like to thank all of our listeners who sent in some great questions and comments. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.